Hey listeners, this podcast was recorded a few months before its release, so you might notice a few references that are slightly out of date.
Wow, that is fascinating.
I made it up.
Well, Joanna, you should just have your own school of thought. So
I do every day.
Hello, and welcome to The Conversation with Susan
and Whitney,
the podcast where two friends from college discuss shared interests, insights, and how we're navigating our lives today.
This is an ongoing conversation about how we're surviving
and thriving.
We discuss the important
and the trivial
and other fun topics in between.
I'm Susan Field, a writer and teacher in Philadelphia.
And I'm Whitney Gould, a writer and marketing director in New Hampshire.
Whitney, you're the kind of friend who scored exactly the same as me on the Myers-Briggs personality test, which explains why you get me so well. We're ENFJ, by the way.
Yes, Susan. And I love that our Myers-Briggs type is called the protagonist because we love books, movies, and other types of drama. But Susan, you're the kind of friend who always understands where I'm at with my mental health and encourages me to take better care of myself when I'm not doing it already.
Oh, Whitney, you do that for me too. So today, as we're recording, this is on June 13th. Tomorrow is the last day of school for School District of Philadelphia teachers. And I have a lot of mixed feelings about that. It's been an incredibly challenging year, but at the same time, it always feels a little bittersweet to say goodbye to students who are graduating, moving on. And so I have a lot of different emotions right now. Excited, but a little bit, you know, sorry to say goodbye.
Yeah, it's always hard, like transitions, right? When you come to the end of something, even if you come to the end of something stressful.
Yeah, definitely. It's like hard to believe that it's over after all we've been through, but it is. And in light of the end of the school year, we have a special guest on today's episode who can help us put this very unique and challenging school year into perspective. So on today's show, our guest is Joanna Schwartz, a teacher, a mental health expert and author, and also an ENFP on the Myers-Briggs scale. Joanna's book, The Teacher Toolbox for a Calm and Connected Classroom, Teacher-Friendly Mental Health Strategies to Help You and Your Students Thrive, was released last summer. Joanna and I met a few years ago when we were both teaching at a school in South Philly, and now we both work as ESL teachers in the district.
Joanna holds master's degrees in education and counseling. She's worked as an elementary school teacher in Philadelphia for about 10 years and also worked as a family and child therapist for 7 years.
I know that not everyone listening today is a teacher or a student or even a parent of a student, but everyone is touched by education in some way, even if indirectly. So today, Joanna is going to talk us through some mental health strategies and tips to help those of us that are in education and beyond approach our next challenges in a more healthy and balanced way. Mental health advice, Whitney, I'm sure you can agree, is human advice. So I think there will be value in this conversation for everyone. And without further ado, welcome Joanna Schwartz.
Hi, Susan. Hi, Whitney. Thank you for having me here.
Well, thanks for being on. It's great to have you.
Yeah, we're so excited. So, Joanna, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your book and why you wrote it?
Sure. So I'm kind of like a teacher-counselor sandwich. So I started out as a teacher in 2001. I think it was 2002. Because it was right after, it was a couple months after 9/11. Anyway, taught for a couple of years. Then I felt like there was something missing. Like there was some kind of like secret language that teachers, really good teachers, knew that the rest of us were trying to figure out. I just felt like there's some invisible language. And I came to discover that that really was like the language of psychology. So through a mysterious series of events, I landed at a holistic counseling program. So I have a degree in counseling with a concentration in holistic studies. So think like mind, body, spirit. So in any case, so I did that. I did a master's program in counseling. And then I started working as a counselor. And one of the first jobs that I had was involved us training teachers a little bit about mental health, but we also had kids who were trauma impacted kids who were clients. So we used to go into schools and watch these kids. And when I would go into the school to watch the kids, I also had an eye out for the teacher. And cause, you know, I'd been that person, but I now knew the backstory of this kid. whereas the teacher was seeing, you know, like the tip of the iceberg, I knew what the iceberg was. I knew the shape and contents of the iceberg because I'd been in the kid's home and because I did therapy with the kid's family. And we had the supervisor, he used to say, just the kid is the canary in the coal mine of the family. So in any case, I had all of these explanations for these kids' behaviors, not excuses, but explanations that the teacher didn't. And I started thinking to myself, holy crap, we need to explain some of this stuff to teachers, but they're so freaking busy. We need to explain it to them in a way that like really makes sense. So I started writing these trainings, and I did that for, well, I did that until I won a contest on MSNBC, which is a whole other story, but it gave me funding to quit my job as a therapist and just write these trainings full time. And those trainings became Toolbox for Teachers. And that was the beginning of the book, because then about a year, maybe 7 months before the pandemic, before the quarantine, a publishing company over in England, which is Jessica Kingsley, reached out to me and they said, hey, have you ever thought about taking these trainings that you've been doing for teachers about mental health and putting them in a book? And I was like, sure. I mean, I had to like go through the whole
proposal. I remember that. I remember meeting up with you, like, I don't know, for drinks or something. And you came in and you were like, guess what happened to me today? And I was like, what? And you were like, someone asked me to write a book. And I was like, what? Totally, oh my God. Great.
Totally out of the blue. How do you say no to that? You know, right. How often does the universe present that at your door? Right. So I wrote the book during the pandemic, and yeah, it came out last summer. Yep. Yeah. Yep. That's how the book came about.
Great. I remember it well. I was at the book launch. So Joanna, after being virtual for the last year and a half for teachers were due to the pandemic, this school year resumed in person, at least for us in Philadelphia. Some schools perhaps remained virtual a little longer, but it was one of the most challenging years for everyone involved. And I feel like your book came out really like right when we were returning to school. So it was very timely in that it offers advice for calm and connected classroom in a time where I feel like things were anything but that, right? So why do you think the mission of your book is so important? And actually, I feel like you already answered that, but why do you think it's so important this year more than ever, now more than ever? Why are these strategies in your mission, you know, significant?
I mean, unfortunately, we've had mass shootings. We've never stopped having these mass shootings. So it's always been an issue. And it's always something you carry around as a teacher. And I'm sure as a parent, I'm not a parent, but sending your kid into a school. So I think we've had mental health at the forefront of our mind, even though we know that most of the shooters did not have diagnosable mental illness prior to the shootings. You also have teacher burnout. So like, I know that in Philadelphia, there's been like record numbers of teachers quitting mid-year. And then you also have these, you have a lot of kids coming in who are not only behind academically, because they are, but they're behind behaviorally. They don't know how to be in a school. Mm-hmm. Which presents its own set of challenges, because now we're not only, you know, we're still supposed to be running the same race, but our athletes don't have that set of skills to keep up. They're not even starting at the same starting line. They're further back, but we still have to get them to the finish line. And that in itself is super stressful for teachers and challenges our mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100% coming from a teacher, but I think anybody that's observed this past year would agree with that as well.
And I don't think it's just teachers. I think like we're all affected by this. Obviously, teachers are affected differently. You know, my line of work doesn't involve me having to think about whether my workplace will be, you know, the site of a mass shooting, for example. But, you know, it all is still heavy on the society in general. So, Joanna, a major symbol in your book is the invisible backpack that both teachers and students carry into the classroom each day. Can you briefly explain what this invisible backpack is?
Sure. I don't know how brief I can be, but it was what I was talking about before when I was saying that as a therapist, I would go into the classroom sometimes to watch my clients, and I would know the hidden story behind the kid. So, you know, all of us are carrying around an invisible backpack of our past traumas, of our own attachment theory that we have from our family of origin, our own styles of interacting in conflict that we've learned throughout our lifetimes. And we bring them into the classroom, and then we interact with other people who have their own invisible backpack, and everything kind of crashes around and collides together. But I actually tell the story in the book. I had a young girl who her mother that day was getting like a routine. It was like some not life-threatening surgery in the hospital. Susan, I don't know if you remember this part, but she herself had been adopted. So she came in with increased sensitivity towards abandonment, towards being abandoned. So a child without that invisible backpack, with a big part of that invisible backpack being fear of abandonment, maybe would not have reacted this way. But what happened for her was I actually gave her a pie chart. I drew a big circle and I asked her what was on her mind that day, and to cut it up into chunks that like represented the different areas that she was thinking about that were on her mind. And she, of course, cut up a big chunk for her mother. Maybe it was 60, 75% or something. And then there was all these other little tiny parts she was thinking about. Her cat was sick that day. And so she kept thinking about her cat. Was her cat okay? Because she had gone to stay with a family friend, you know? And when you're a kid or even an adult like us, your animals can be like your world. She was starving. She was too nervous to eat. I think she had a test. And these were just like occupying small slivers of her pie chart. But to the uninitiated, or to those who didn't know better, you might just think, you know, if she was at school, her mind would be on what was happening in front of her. But actually, like, our invisible backpack weighs heavy and takes up a large part of our attention.
That makes a lot of sense. So, Joanna, in your observation, how do you think the school community handled the idea of their invisible backpacks this year, of like bringing them back into the classroom after a year of being not in the classroom?
I can't speak for all schools, but I can extrapolate based on what I've heard other teachers say in my own experience. I think schools were very, very eager to get back to normal. We didn't want to talk about the fact that the world had been rocked and burned down. And we just wanted kids to learn two-digit addition, and we wanted to get them reading on level, and we wanted to keep asking teachers to do a ridiculous amount of paperwork.
Yeah,
I mean,
that too.
I don't know, Susan, if that has, if that's also been
yours. Yeah, I feel like there was a feeling that we got behind during the pandemic, which in a lot of cases is true, but I feel like then that was seen as, okay, we're in this deficit. Now we have to work extra hard to catch everybody up, which, you know, I understand needing to work hard to make up for some lost time, but it really was extra stressful then for both the teachers and the students to have to make up this ground that is a little bit impossible to make up in 1 year. You know, I felt a lot of pressure with having to do that and a strain that was in my backpack, is just this expectation to make up for lost time that we really can't get back, honestly.
You know, and I really just think it's so easy. It's not so easy to address, but just to address the humanity in the room. You know, I've been in so many meetings, and I'm not naming any schools, but I've been in just so many meetings where it's just sit down, open the agenda, item number one. Mm-hmm. Let's stop for a second. You know, let's even just talk for, you know, one meeting a month about the actual kids and their invisible backpack, and how does it feel to be interacting with them, and what little things happen with them. You know, a friend of mine was telling me today that she was at graduation, and one of the kids, he showed up, he didn't have the right clothes on, and his family wasn't there. And she said her heart just went out to him because it's graduation, everyone's family's there taking pictures, and, you know, just the opportunity to think about the humanity of these kids and what they need and how we can support them. And that really is what the book is about. And really, honestly, I should also say, just not the kids, but just our own humanity and what we need and deserve.
Yes, Joanna. And just a quick note that you mentioned prominently in your book was about putting Maslow before Bloom. And for those that don't know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs is basically what, like a pyramid of, I guess you could explain it better than me, Joanna, but a pyramid of what we require as humans, like, you know, what's on the bottom of the pyramid, like security, safety, and then like love, acceptance, and it builds all the way up to the top.
You
need like those basic elements, like you need to be fed, you need to be clothed, you need to be comfortable and feel good about yourself in order for you to do anything else. And Bloom's taxonomy, Bloom, basically it's like what levels of thinking, right? Higher levels of thinking, higher levels of questioning, things like that. It's
the way that we learn. Yeah. Like,
yeah, it's an academic framework, really. It's the six major categories of thought. And we always try to get up to the highest levels of thinking.
Yes.
But what I'm saying is you have to have Maslow's hierarchy of needs before you can get to any of those higher levels of thinking and questioning.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think it was a little backward this year.
Every year. Schools bloom before, they try to bloom before they Maslow. There's actually a chapter in the book, you know, it's really like this feelings first that people have. It's this real need to have their feelings addressed first before we can ask them to learn anything. You know, like they say, no one cares what you know until they know that you care.
Oh, yeah. That's true, Joanna. I think that's really important. And even as I'm sort of reflecting on what you're saying, I think I could have done a better job of putting some of the basic needs before learning. But
oh, me too.
You
me
know,
too.
I did try my very best to focus on how the kids were feeling every day. And actually, that's a segue into my next question is, what were some of the mental health strategies, maybe from your book, maybe not from your book, but what were some of the strategies that you used successfully this year with your students, some mental health strategies?
So a lot of the mental health strategies that I use, I think are meant more for teachers who have kids for extended periods of time. You know, I just have my kids for 45 minutes a day. I'm an ESOL teacher this year for the first time. So it was very brief periods of time and then bringing them back and getting another group. But what I really feel that I tried to do was I tried to make sure that all of the children felt seen, whether it was just making sure I like used their name and looked at them in the eye. And the other thing, although I think really made a difference, was because I had some individuals who were really just learning how to be in school. You know, I tried to kind of like, I think, see the oak tree and the acorn. So like to see, for example, I had like, you know, a little boy who's like super chatty, but I could actually see that this is kind of like this is a people person. And like this little boy, the acorn, this little boy, when he grows up and becomes an oak tree, like, and we see the full expression of his personality, this is a person who is a social butterfly. He could manage a store. He could actually be a fabulous teacher. So I really tried this year, and I feel grateful that in the last several years I've been able to do this, to reframe how I see people and kids, to get to a point where I can love them, because I'm not going to be able to educate anyone that I don't love. And I really don't think I've met a kid I don't love. In the moment, I may not love them, but I do love them and I see their beauty and uniqueness.
Oh, Joanna, that's so profound. I got chills when you said that. And reframing. So can you just go a little bit more into reframing and sort of how do you get yourself to get into that reframe mindset?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, there's this book, I think it's called The Spirited Child, that has this great list of reframes, ways that we can see like annoying or challenging behavior. Okay. So I'll read you like some of the traditional ways that we think of the behavior and then like a more helpful reframe way of seeing it. So for example, a kid who's stubborn, you know, and going back to, you know, this not just being about classrooms, this could be your spouse, your whoever it is. Stubborn is really also just determined, wild. I was a wild child, free spirited, fussy, discriminating tastes. True, right? The reviewers of the world, rigid, structured, or a heightened sense of order. Let's see, shy, has a rich inner world, disorganized, creative. And how about, I love this one, manipulative, feels more comfortable when they are in control. Ooh. You know, I had a teacher complain to me about a kid she thought was manipulative. And I really did remember working as a counselor and seeing like, oh, these are just kids who felt very out of control at home and had to learn how to be in control.
Wow. Well, those are really valuable reframes for anybody in any workplace or any human interaction. So I appreciate you sharing those. Those were really great to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Mary Sheedy. I'm going to mispronounce her name. Kursinka, Kurcinka. That's her book, Raising Your Spirited Child.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, and there's a chapter about reframes in the book. Oh, you know, and another thing about that is, you know, when we have the difficult kids in our class, to actually find out their strengths from other teachers who, yeah, Whitney, you're nodding. Like, what did you love about this kid last year? Help me see this kid differently. Or ask the parent, you know, tell me your favorite story about your kid. What's something you wish that I would know about your child before the school year starts? I'm just learning about them. What do I need to know? And it can blow your mind, the things that they say.
You're right, Joanna. I was just actually thinking about when we were at the same school a couple years ago, there was one student who I loved. He was great, but he was a little chatty and a little high energy. And sometimes, you know, he could just maybe cause a little problem in the classroom just because he's talking all the time.
Sure.
Super sweet kid. But I asked his teacher from the previous year and she was like, oh my gosh, wasn't he great? He was so enthusiastic. Enthusiastic student. And I was like, you know what? That's very true. And I really reframed the way I was thinking, like, no, he wasn't like too chatty. He was super excited to be there and he was super excited to be a part of the class. And that really helped me to see him in a more positive way. And I never forgot that.
And Susan, even if you think about, and Whitney, I can ask you this too. When you were growing up, did you ever have a teacher say something negative about you or an adult or parent or someone that later as you grow up, you're like, that's what makes me great. Mm-hmm. I'm so curious what was said about both of you.
So in kindergarten, I was woken up from a nap one time to finish my paper that I was working on, like our little assignment paper where we were associating the first letter of words with the picture. So like if it was cat, you had to put C. And this was just like kind of a funny one, but they thought that I had like a learning disability because for hat, I put T. But like growing up where I did, it was a picture of a winter hat with like a pom-pom. And like, we did not call that a hat. We called that a toboggan. So I put T for toboggan. And they were like, oh, like they thought I was getting the word backwards.
Oh, and actually and you had a more ample vocabulary than they knew.
Right. So then they were like, another thing that same year, which contributed to this, you know, they thought potentially I had a learning disability, was that I colored very slow and carefully. Mm-hmm. And when they asked me about that, I explained that my mom and I used to color at home before I went to kindergarten. And she taught me how to color like carefully and in the lines. And I was always trying to color like my mom. And so they, instead of just like scribbling all over the page and calling it a day, I was actually trying to like, you know, color like a grown up. So apparently I was just more advanced than they expected in kindergarten.
Wow. Yeah, they might have said you were slow. But you know, probably as you're about yourself as an adult, that like you do things well and you take care and you pay attention to details. That's the same little girl. That's part of who you are. It's a strength of yours.
Whitney, your story about the word that you had a different word for it, that makes me think too that, you know, sometimes students have answers that we weren't expecting or that maybe we didn't come into it that day thinking that was the right answer, but we have to be open to other people's perspectives and know that everybody comes from a different background and has different thoughts. So that's important that maybe our answer isn't always the right answer, right? Everyone has a different perspective. There's many right answers.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was just a quick side thought. But for me, I remember teachers saying I was very conscientious. I think that I did take a lot of time. In fact, maybe too much time on things, which still true today. Mm-hmm. Something else is I was very shy and I remember the teachers would always comment that I wouldn't really talk to them. So I don't know what that says about me. That's not the case anymore, but.
Well, it sounds like you were careful about who you wanted to communicate with.
Yeah, I think maybe it was just a comfort thing too. Yeah, maybe I needed to feel more comfortable in the space, needed to get to know them more, maybe needed more encouragement. But yeah, it's really interesting thinking back on these things. What did a teacher say about you, Joanna?
I had a lot of positive reinforcement as a kid. I remember I had one teacher let me like create my own play. She was like, you read really well. Do you want to create a play? And she let me go out in the hallway and I became like a director.
Oh my goodness.
Little kids. And then I brought the kids back in. We had backgrounds and everything. And I think as an adult, that is still a part of me. And you can see it in my classroom where I want to be creative and I want to run things. And I want people to bring their talents into the mix.
Oh, that's so true of you. So true. I loved coming into your room because you were always like, oh, Ms. Fields here, everyone, let's show her what we just learned. And they would like present something for me. It was great.
It was awesome. It's just such a joyful job. There's so much opportunity for joy when you work with children.
So Joanna, what are some other strategies from your books that you think teachers, students, and even a broader audience could use to create some more calm and connectivity other than reframing?
Sure. You know, a big one for me is when times get rough, and I've had rough times. When times get rough, I think the things that I turn to are intention and gratefulness. And I know that sounds very yoga-y, but I'll explain. And I mean them in a very like down-to-earth way. So intention, when I go into a difficult situation, even if it's a conversation with my family that I don't want to have, I try to set in my mind that after this conversation, I'm going to feel better than before this conversation. Or if I'm going to work with a difficult class, that after the class, I'm going to walk out of it feeling great. I set that is what is going to happen. And then my actions kind of like follow suit. And that helps me through a lot of hard times. And there's something magical about it, I think. It's also just, you know, kind of what you decide to do. The other thing is really on horrible days where I like really feel like I cannot get through, I try to really be grateful for the nitty gritty. Like Susan, you might remember when we did our Mindful Mondays, The first thing that I tried to do was have everyone share like little moments from their day for which they feel grateful. And they really are, the smaller for me, the better, you know, because when we get like grandiose, we're like, I'm grateful for my family, I'm grateful for my house. But like, you know, I'm grateful for this cup of coffee. I'm grateful for this soft chair that I'm in. I'm grateful there's air conditioning on me and there's sunlight coming through the window and just the littlest things. And no one can take that from you, no matter how poor your circumstances are. There's still the opportunity to see beauty and goodness in the world in any given moment.
Absolutely. Mindset is everything. I wish that you were in my ear more this year, Joanna. I probably should have been talking to you more.
I needed people in my ear too. Mm-hmm. But I am like determined to stay positive, and I have my up days and down days just like everyone else.
We're all human.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So now that this school year and everyone has been back to work and in person, this is really the new normal now. And it's been that way for pretty much this year. So let's just reflect briefly on some lessons that were learned this past year. So do you have any insights about any big mental health lessons that maybe you learned or that you've talked to other people that they've learned throughout this school year that we are just about to finish tomorrow, Joanna?
You know, the simplest one that I do and that you can do anywhere, no matter what, really is just pausing and breathing. Mm. So like my hero, this woman, Tish Jennings, she's a professor at UVA, and they did this like large scale study on mindfulness with teachers, and they gave them all these strategies. And afterwards, I think they asked them, I believe I read, they asked them like, what's been like the one thing that you feel like you learned from this that you'll carry on? And they said, just taking 3 breaths. Mm. So I actually do that with the kids, and I will say to them, like, I'm going to yell at you. I don't want to yell at you. Please let me breathe for a minute. And I've now seen them doing it, because I kind of do this thing before I start class where like it's kind of like a Qigong thing where we bring our arms up and then down. And when we bring our arms down, it's kind of like calming the energy. And I've seen the kids do it themselves now. So I feel like no matter where we are, if we can just take a second and breathe, and believe me, I forget over and over to do this. It's, you know, they say like all research is me search. You know, I needed to write this book. I needed 1,000 strategies, because this stuff makes me crazy too. And children, the challenge, you know, it is freaking challenging. I don't think humans were meant to be in a room, one human in a room with 30 children. You know, it's a recipe for insanity. So my best tip really is just to take those 4 breaths, sometimes 8 breaths, sometimes ask the kids to do it with you, and then it grounds you back in the moment.
Mm, so important to remember that. I often forget to breathe.
Same. I was just going to say, like, even sometimes when I set reminders, like my Fitbit, you can do like a little quick deep breathing exercise on your Fitbit, like if you have like a Fitbit watch. And I know it's there and I like pan past it all the time, but do you think I ever remember to use it?
I know, right? I know.
So, Joanna, how do you think some of these action items can be applied to sectors outside of education or in real life? So like in potentially in other work settings, maybe?
Reflective listening. So for example, there's a story I tell in the book. A friend of mine, her 9-year-old daughter, I think, was walking down the stairs in their house and she dropped the laptop. And my friend, her mother, heard her just start crying. And she went over to her and she said to her, her daughter actually started getting like hysterical. And it became like, you know, it's like bigger than the actual event. It's like,
yeah.
You start like crying for everything that's bothering you. Anyway, my friend said to her, you know, I think she said like, oh, it's so scary to fall. It can be so scary to fall. Where does it hurt? Are you okay? But just that sentence, it can be so scary to fall, or it's so scary to fall, names the other person's like emotional experience. And I do not do this enough. But Whitney, you asked about crossover, just naming the other people's emotional experience, reflecting it. You know, it can take the form of like, it's so blank to blank. Or you could say, I hear you saying that you feel this. Or it seems so this to this. You're just naming it from their point of view, which can be really hard if you don't agree with their point of view. You know, so, you know, your partner they do a project at work and they kind of get like overlooked. You know, you could say to them, you could name those feelings for them like, oh, you know, it's so disappointing after all the hard work you put in to not be acknowledged.
Yeah.
And then not feel that you have to fix it, especially men out there who are hearing this. Like, don't feel that you have to fix it. Just sit with the other person's feelings and it will feel icky. But just you sitting in that space with them will help them to move out of that and heal. They just need presence. A lot of times they just need presence.
I love that. I need to get better at doing that.
Me too.
Yeah. So I have a couple of thoughts on that. You said earlier, you know, kind of reflecting someone's feelings back to them, saying like, you hear what they're saying, or you hear that they're feeling a certain thing. I try to do that with my employee at work and he hates it because apparently I only ever use it when I'm about to disagree with him. So I say, I hear you, but
the red flag.
Oh, the butt can be hard. Sometimes you have to say it. And then I think not sometimes, every time you have to say it and you have to let it land. And like, truly,
like pause.
Yep.
I hear you.
Pause. Stop.
Right.
Like stop talk. Stop trying to go to where you're going. And I believe me, Whitney, I know how hard that is to do. I know how hard that is to do.
Yep.
And the word but can be hard, can negate everything you said before that. It will negate everything you said before that. I'm so sorry I was late, but I had other things to do. It just took away the I'm so sorry.
Yeah. That's yeah, it is the butt. I'm afraid that my employee is about to make like, I don't know, a shirt or a hat or something with make it like my catchphrase at some point. So
what would the catchphrase be? I hear you, butt.
I hear you, butt.
But I disagree. Well, that's really good to think about, Joanna. I'm going to have to spend some time pondering that and thinking about how I can use this reflective listening. But Joanna, one of the things I love the most about my time working with you at our school in South Philly was the Mindfulness Monday group that you already mentioned earlier. And for those that don't know, that was a group of teachers that would come to your room after school and we would have hot tea and we would close our eyes and listen to your water feature and reflect the confidence of our day. Yeah, I would always leave your classroom saying, okay, I need to buy an electric tea kettle. I need a water feature, like everything that you had. I was really? Like, let me recreate this. But it was so great because we'd always reflect on the positives of that day, like you said, kind of like the little moments. And you usually had some kind of a specific focus that we would talk about in that session, you know, a different healthy way of handling stress in our classrooms and how to handle our students with better care. And I just love this idea of Mindfulness Monday. And obviously that doesn't have to just apply to education. That could apply to families and any office or industry. So I'd love if more people and more industries and families would do something like a Mindfulness Monday where they'd take a chance to reflect and think about how they could, you know, have a more healthy living situation.
Well, I do know. I think, you know, a simple thing to do is just to bring up a quote, put up an inspiring quote and ask people how they relate, how the previous week's experiences relate to that quote, and make it about, you know, trying to make it about just being compassionate and all of those things we've been talking about. I mean, literally you could also take a chapter a week from my book and just, you know, read it and then talk about it in that week's meeting.
Joanna, is there anything else that you would want to share with listeners about the topic of mental health as we continue to figure out how to survive and thrive during these challenging times?
I mean, yeah, the only other things I can really think of are just sort of just making sure that you spend time in silence and you spend time in nature. I tell the kids a lot of times that we need food and water and movement and sleep, but we also need silence. I think it's a necessity to not just always come home and turn on Netflix or be looking, scrolling through, but just silence, I think, is so healing, and time in nature. But that's all I got for now.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've actually been trying to incorporate more silence, and not really, like, it's not like I set out to say, oh, let me put more silence in my day, but I've needed the silence so much that it's just happened. Because Whitney and I always talk about the podcasts we listen to, the audiobooks, whatever, but lately I've needed to not listen to those things because my mind is just so overly stimulated. I just need the silence, and it is very healing and restorative.
Yes. And you know what, Susan and Whitney, as if I can go back on my answer, you know, I just read a great book. I just did The Artist Way, 12-week program.
Morning pages are like a godsend. Like, I will be honest
with you. Whitney got me into that. I haven't done that recently, but Whitney, you were the one that told me about the morning pages. Yeah.
But there's a week there where you're not allowed to read. And so I took that into like, and also no texting and no radio programs or nothing, no other voices. And it was so helpful for me to recover my own voice.
Yeah. I also just love a good plane ride wearing noise-canceling headphones that don't have anything playing in them, you know? Just like drown out some noise and have, you know, a moment of zen, as The Daily Show would say, right? Here's your moment of zen. So
yeah, I'm with you.
I don't have noise-canceling headphones. Should I get some?
There you go. They're life-changing. This is my first pair of like truly noise-canceling headphones. Like, I've had others that said they were, but weren't really. And it's a game changer.
Amazing. That's good.
Yeah. So,
Joanna, can you tell readers where they can purchase a copy of your book and where can they find you on social media?
Amazon.com, baby. It's called The Teacher Toolbox for a Calm and Connected Classroom, teacher-friendly mental health strategies to help you and your students thrive. Teacher Toolbox for a Calm and Connected Classroom. I am on Instagram as Toolbox for Teachers. I'm on Facebook as Toolbox for Teachers.
Great.
Well, Joanna, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today, especially on the eve of the last day of school, which is, you know, as we discussed, a celebration, but also bittersweet.
Lots of feelings to go around.
Definitely.
Yeah, we really appreciate your time tonight. Join us next time when we pick up where we left off and continue the conversation.
Check us out on Instagram at Susan and Whitney, or send us an email at susanandwhitney@gmail.com.
That's SUSAN. The word and, WHITTNEY.
Our awesome music is by Offshane, and our scripting and editing is by us.
Talk to you later.
Yay, I think we did a good job.